Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A day after the U.S. significantly shifted its stance on Iran's nuclear program, President Bush today had tough words for Iran, but started by saying he supports the new diplomatic path, including direct talks, to resolve the impasse over Iran's uranium enrichment program.
I want to solve it peacefully. And the best thing for the Iranians to understand is that if they choose not to suspend and verify, if they continue their obstinance, they continue to say to the world, we really don't care what your opinion is, then the world is going to act in concert. And the next step of acting in concert is to go to the United Nations Security Council.
The president spoke after meeting with his cabinet this morning. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is meeting with European Union leaders in Vienna, and they reportedly are close to a deal that would offer Iran economic incentives if the country gives up its nuclear activities that could produce a bomb. Joining us on the line is Brian Bender of the Boston Globe. Brian, what happened here? For months leading up to this week, there had been a lot of saber-rattling towards Iran coming from the White House.
That's true, but I think what's clear is that behind the scenes, the State Department has been talking with the Germans, the French, the British, and more recently the Russians and the Chinese to come to some sort of agreement about what collectively can be done if Iran does not take this offer to stop its uranium enrichment. And I think the United States really had little choice but at least to give the Iranians one more choice to come to the table, one more choice to talk directly with the Americans. And if not, it sounds like they have a set of initiatives in place, sanctions, and other punishments if the Iranians don't agree.
Well, your paper in an editorial today said that Secretary Rice was also talking with President Bush and perhaps changed his mind just a little bit.
I think certainly the Bush administration, President Bush, has been unwilling to directly talk to the Iranians over this for some time. You know, the Europeans have been talking to the Iranians for a year and a half, and the Americans haven't been there. And I think it's quite possible that the time came where Secretary Rice and others probably came to the president and said, you really have no choice. If you're going to get international support, you need, particularly from the Russians and the Chinese, who have a veto in the Security Council, if you're going to get that support, you're going to have to offer some sort of carrot, and I think that's what happened here.
Well, let's talk about the if in the phrase that Secretary Rice used yesterday when she said that the U.S. would join direct talks with Iran if Iran gives up its nuclear enrichment program. How is this being seen? I mean, that's a pretty big if.
It's a huge if, and in fact, we've already seen some response out of Iran that it's a non-starter. I think, though, they very carefully yesterday used the language a halt to the Iranians' enrichment activities. Didn't say stop, destroy. It was the word halt, which I think was a bit of an opening for Iran domestically, for Iran's leaders to have a way out from looking like they're totally crumbling to the United States.
Well, what happens now, Brian?
Well, I think now the ball is in Iran's court, clearly. I mean, the government there is going to have to decide whether it wants to take this offer. I think the pressure is on. Iran clearly is getting the message that if it doesn't take some action, that it's going to go before the United Nations and possibly suffer from some sanctions, which, you know, from what we gather, could be pretty serious and could affect the Iranian economy.
Well, and on the other hand, the opposite of sanctions, economic incentives, and there is word from Vienna that the U.S. and European nations are close to a sort of carrot and stick. You mentioned the carrot. That's the carrot part, the economic incentives deal for Iran. What would that entail?
Well, you know, it's not really clear yet, but clearly one of the initiatives may be to assist Iran in a civilian nuclear power program. That's another thing that was significant yesterday in this offer to Iran. Clearly, the Bush administration is now stating very forcefully that it believes Iran has a right to a nuclear program, just not a nuclear weapon. It's allowed to have nuclear power. I think one of the incentives would be to help Iran build some of those nuclear reactors that it wants to you know, for civilian electrical power.
Brian Bender, Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. Brian, thanks very much.
Sure.
This week marks the 25th anniversary of AIDS. Each day, according to the UN, 8,000 people around the world die from AIDS. 25 million people have died from the disease since the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the U.S. reported the first cases of a rare pneumonia appearing in homosexuals 25 years ago. Today, we take a closer look at AIDS, at its early days in the U.S., and how developing countries are dealing with it today. Our guest is author Phil Hiltz, who began covering the story before ever anyone even knew what AIDS was. Phil, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And can you remind us what the early days were like? We were just saying that we have people in our office younger than this illness.
Yes.
You know, what was it like? And is there one anecdote that stands out that sort of is a metaphor for that time?
Well, yes. In the beginning, we really didn't know what we were dealing with. I remember sitting in the newsroom on a Saturday morning, and this little report came in from the Centers for Disease Control in the summer of 1981. And I didn't know what it was. It was some kind of unusual disease we didn't have a name for, and it was in homosexuals. I thought, this is really strange. So we wrote a story, and then it started growing, you know, 50, 100, 200 dead, 500 dead. By the next year, we were saying, this is the major medical mystery of our time.
Well, and I remember at the time reading a little report in the Times, in the New York Times,
yes,
and going to my then boss at the Today Show. And he said, yeah, but it's just in one community, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's hard to imagine now, but people really were thinking, well, but it's just confined to that one homosexual.
That was the argument in the beginning, and it was easy for many people to ignore the gay community. And this was actually the coming out of the gay community, in a way, a part of the step forward. And it was those people pushing on the government to get them to recognize this. For example, you had Ronald Reagan was president, and he didn't even mention AIDS for the first 5 years of the epidemic. Didn't make a speech on it for 7 years. If you can have an epidemic that's killing thousands of people and have the president not even mention it, that's really denial. In fact, every country around the world that has had the epidemic starts there with denial. They
even now?
Hide. Yes, even now. Right now, the epidemic has gone in three big phases. We're in phase three, where it's hitting Asia and Russia, India, China. There, what they have right now is denial. They're not talking about it. They're just beginning to understand it. They're just seeing the cases. Reporters in newspapers in India refuse to deal with it.
Yeah.
So they're in denial. In South Africa, where the Southern Africa in general, where the epidemic is the highest, they went through a period of 10 years of denial, and they're just coming out of it.
Yeah, and here in this country, don't you think it wasn't until Magic Johnson said that he
yes,
had...
Yes, in each of these countries, you also see this funny phenomenon that while people are not talking about it, they keep in that mode, and then some celebrity steps forward and says, I have it, or we had Arthur Ashe and we had Magic Johnson. That's the moment when people said, oh, really, you know, it's okay if a recognizable person mm-hmm. can tell us, then we can maybe start talk about that celebrity and then gradually talk about the subject.
Is it true that the virus is still spreading, but it's slower?
Yes. In the U.S., the spread is much, much slower than it was. The number of deaths are way down. From the time we got the triple drug combination in 1996 and 97, the number of deaths were 50,000 or more a year, and then they dropped down to 6,000. So we're down at a lower level, but it continues on. I mean, the virus does move. It's not gone away.
What about the spread of it? How many new cases are there? And not just here, but around the world.
The spread is fairly low in the U.S., but in other places it's quite high. So, for example, in India, in China, it's rising up rapidly. In Russia, the rate is now 16 times what it was a few years ago.
Right.
So the frontier areas, India, China, and Russia, are going up dramatically, and they're in denial, just like we were. In South Africa, Southern Africa, the number has leveled off, and in a couple of places, Zimbabwe and Botswana seems to be going down a little bit for the first time.
Well, let's talk about some of those areas. You mentioned South Africa. One estimate is that the Saharan Africa will see 1 to 2 million new infections each year for the next 10 or 20 years. It's been described as the epidemiological perfect storm for spreading AIDS. Why? What happened there?
Southern Africa is in the second wave. We had the first wave, which was America and East Africa, and those have gone down now. Those are much better under control. But in Southern Africa, which has a slightly different virus and different behavior patterns, it took off at about 1990 to 92 and is still going up. Mm. And you have rates now in Southern African countries anywhere between 20% and 40% of the adult population with HIV. Well, and again, it's denial is the main element. People don't want to get tested. They don't want to talk about it. And the governments, in the case of South Africa, the president is the one who was saying that HIV doesn't cause AIDS. It's poverty that causes AIDS. I don't know what that means. The Minister of Health is one who said, oh, well, you can treat this by taking garlic in your diet. I mean, it's just...
And then the deputy president, who we just saw on trial for accused of raping a woman, he was cleared, but he said it was consensual and he was safe because he took a shower. And he'd been the head of an AIDS commission.
He was the head of the National AIDS Council in South Africa. So this is a good indication of the kind of problem you have, people simply not facing it.
You mentioned the countries that are in this third wave where it's just reaching them, China, India. How do we know what's going on? I mean, these are, well, in China in particular, closed countries. How do we know really what's going on?
The numbers aren't great, but we do have numbers because the World Health Organization is in all these places and does studies. And so we do have some numbers that seem fairly reliable. And so we know the rate in India is pretty high, relatively speaking. We're getting up near 5%, and in some populations, of course, much more. It started with drug users and prostitutes and is spreading. The same in China. China's a little step behind, but they're now the same thing from drug users and prostitutes, and they're just recognizing it. They're just starting to talk about it. And so that, now they're giving us numbers for the first time. So these are areas that are going to be coming up dramatically in the next few years if they don't do something.
Author and health and science reporter Phil Hiltz talking about AIDS today, and we're going to hear much more from Phil. But he mentioned the denial in the U.S. in the early days of the epidemic, rather, and the fact that it took President Reagan years to address it. The first time he mentioned AIDS publicly was in 1986. A year later, Reagan gave his first public speech about AIDS and established the Presidential Commission on HIV. Here is President Reagan speaking at an AIDS research fundraiser in 1987.
America faces a disease that is fatal and spreading, and this calls for urgency, not panic. It calls for compassion, not blame. And it calls for understanding, not ignorance.
That's President Ronald Reagan speaking in 1987 about AIDS, the same year he set up a presidential commission on HIV, but 6 years after the first cases appeared in the U.S. Well, we want to hear from you as well. Do you have early memories of the AIDS epidemic? Send us your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call, leave a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Now, please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. We'd love to hear from you. Well, just ahead, we'll hear more from author Phil Hilt. We'll look at some of the solutions in country, including condom use and good government, but also ask, when is a vaccine coming and why do some AIDS patients never take medications and do quite well? Much more coming up here and now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now, and we're back with author Phil Hiltz, who's been reporting on AIDS since its very early days. And Phil, let's talk about some of the global success stories. For instance, why is Brazil considered such a success in treating AIDS?
Brazil started early, late 1980s. They passed a new constitution that said everybody has the right to health care, and that includes AIDS. And they started prevention and treatment immediately. 1996, when we first got the really good drugs, they got them right away. And they
and
have a
free
pharmaceutical industry that makes them.
Yeah.
And in fact, they've threatened if the big companies from around the world that make these AIDS drugs don't give really low cost, they're going to make them there on their own. They've threatened that. They haven't had to because they've negotiated the prices way, way down. Yeah. But they deliver them now in Brazil to everybody who needs them, and that's about 80% of the ones who need them have come out, got tested, and are getting the drugs. And at the same time, they've had a very strong prevention program. They do ads on condoms. They talk about condoms and sex openly. They have huge use of condoms, and they target sex workers and help out and cooperate with them. And so they have half of the AIDS or less than they were expected to have.
How about Botswana? Why has Botswana been successful?
You know, in every case, the story is leadership. That was the case in Brazil. The same case in Botswana. They have very good leadership. The president, Festus Mogae, is a brilliant guy. He's an economist. And he looked at the situation. And he said, well, you know, this is our whole future. We have to do something about this. So he has led a program, the first program in Africa, to bring treatment to the people. And it's now universal. Everybody has the right to have treatment. And everybody is tested routinely. And so they now have, something like 70,000 people on, and this is a very, very small country, 70,000 people on the drug. There's still a lot of denial, but it's changing. It's rapidly changing, because if you start getting drugs and you see people stand up from their pallets and walk when they are about dead, that's very impressive. And then you think, well, maybe I'll get tested because I'm getting very sick. And that's what's happening there. Thousands of people are now coming out because they can see it working.
We talk about AIDS as this thing that happened, but it's actually part of another thing happening.
Yeah, we always thought it was unusual and weird in one thing, separate, unique. It is not. And scientists now have started to write reports about how this is actually part of globalization. This is part of a new wave. Since the 1970s, we've had 40 new diseases. We've never had anything like that before. We've had 20 old diseases resurging and with much worse kind of symptoms. We're in a stage where people are moving back and forth. A billion people are moving, you know, every year, country to country. And the countries that have the heavy burden of disease to the countries with the light, we have a million people a week going between the diseased countries and the less diseased countries. At the same time, we're tearing down the forest and all these bugs are coming out and attaching to humans, attaching to animals. And so we tear down the environment, we move everybody around, you shuffle everything like that, put it in a mixing bowl, and you're going to have more diseases.
Some of them come to mind, SARS, the threat of avian flu. You're saying that's all considered now part of the
It's part of globalization. And in the first industrial revolution, when we had the first global trade push, it was called the Age of Epidemics, because they had a whole rush of the same thing. They had epidemics of cholera, typhus, and so on. Gradually, we got that under control. Our medicine moved ahead. Our public health procedures got much better. Now we have the second wave. This is the new globalization. We're having exactly the same effect. We're having the wave of diseases when our guard is down. Our public health spending has dropped enormously, and so now we're getting whacked.
Well, in fact, a couple last questions about AIDS and a disease that maybe isn't coming back but has sprung anew. What about that report of a super strain of HIV that was found in New York?
Yes, there have been different strains year by year, and of course the disease moves, the virus changes. And the one in Southern Africa that is the worst place in the world is different than the others. And that's one of the reasons why they have more there. It's more aggressive. It infects more aggressively. And so you're going to find these little outcrops. And these things are going to happen, and we have to keep ahead of them. The other thing is, as a society, we have to pay attention to this and build back up our public health that went way down. As we know from avian flu, we're just starting to realize, hey, wait a minute. This could be really bad. We could have another AIDS. We could have a third, a fourth of these waves. And the only way of handling it is if you have a doctor in a health department in Utah, in Texas, everywhere, every day calling up the hospitals. What have you got? Have you got anything new? That's what we're supposed to have in place. It's not there now.
How far away are we from a vaccine, a preventative measure?
That's one of the strange things about this whole story. I followed it from the beginning, from 81, and we always thought that it's going to be fairly soon. It's going to be fairly soon. Well, 25 years later, it's still going to be fairly soon. So I don't know. There's a vaccine that's been tried in Uganda that looks pretty good. The most likely thing we're going to get is a microbicide, which is very, very powerful.
So the microbicide?
Microbicide is like a lubricant that a woman can use. It can put it on and then have sex, and it will kill the virus. So it's a major preventive measure. And also, for places where it matters, the woman can do it without mentioning it to her husband or to her partner.
We'd hear these anecdotes of someone who was diagnosed, tested and diagnosed, no question about that, and then refused to use the cocktail and is still living.
Yes. There are a few cases of people who are just whose immune systems just for some reason have managed it very, very well. In fact, in Uganda, there's an area and in Kenya, there's an area where the prostitutes have been exposed continuously for years, and they're still healthy. It's not very many people, a few, and so now we're trying to figure out, okay, what have they got that we don't have?
Yeah.
They're studying that, and that's where that new vaccine that is hopeful might come from.
Health and science reporter Phil Hiltz, who's been reporting on the AIDS epidemic, since 81, since before we knew it was an AIDS epidemic. By the way, is this your life's work? I mean, do you assume that you'll be doing this for another 20, 30, 40 years? Or?
Yes. I've been probably 30 countries, and I'm always interested to see. Yeah, it's such a strange story because we saw it happen in the 80s. We knew the denial. We knew we were messing it up. And you go to another country. You go to China now, and you see them doing exactly the same thing. You could hand them an article saying, this is how you're going to behave. This is what you're going to be like. And they read it, and they say, oh, okay. And they just keep doing it. They have blood transmission in China. 85 is when we stopped needing that. I mean, we have a test. We can test our blood. We don't have to transmit it. Today in China, they're transmitting it through the blood. It's nutty,
That's the bad news, is that you're not going to retire early. Phil, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Again, reporter Phil Hiltz. Stay with us. We have much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Posh dinners, box seats at baseball games, junkets to exotic locales. These are some of the perks prescription drug salesmen give to some doctors, ostensibly to talk to them about their products. But these kinds of gifts could be a thing of the past in Massachusetts. The state Senate passed a proposal that would make it the first state to license drug sales reps and ban them from giving gifts of money, travel, or entertainment to doctors or healthcare officials. The state House of Representatives and the governor would have to approve the measure, but if passed, violators could face a fine of up to $5,000 and 2 years in jail. Well, joining us is Dr. Joe Gerstein, a former Tufts Health Plan Administrator in Massachusetts and a whistleblower who sued TAP Pharmaceutical Products after that company offered him $65,000 to keep its prostate cancer drug on the health plan's list of preferred drugs. The company pled guilty and paid an $875 million settlement. Welcome, Dr. Gerstein.
Thanks.
And first of all, what do you think of this news that the Senate here in Massachusetts has passed this ban?
Well, it was kind of a shock to me, and it's I guess the next step along the line of what Vermont has done. After the settlement, there was a large realignment of the so-called ethical guidelines of various medical organizations and the drug industry itself, but these still remain voluntary and, as far as I know from scuttlebutt, are often bypassed and abused.
Well, tell us, what has Vermont done?
Well, Vermont passed a requirement that drug salespeople declare all of their gifts above a certain amount. But I understand that this has had some implementation problems as well.
Well, this in Massachusetts is a plan to talk about an outright ban. Why do you think it's needed? I mean, we hear of a company offering you $65,000 to keep a drug on a preferred list. Is that common?
It's very common. It wasn't a personal offer to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was an offer to give money to Tufts Health Plan for a so-called unrestricted medical education grant, which is, of course, restricted because we wouldn't get it if we didn't know what they wanted.
Yeah, it was a quid pro quo.
Restriction.
Yeah.
This is a very common methodology and obviously is a manipulative and coercive methodology.
Anecdotally, some of us have heard stories. I had a friend invite me out. He said, hey, join me and some other doctors. We're going to go out to dinner and see a jazz concert. And it turned out that the dinner and concert were provided by a drug sales rep who took about 3 minutes during the dinner to say, let's talk about the drug, and then that was it. What are some of the other examples?
Well, I mean, the most egregious sort of thing I would say it too. First of all, my daughter-in-law went to see her gynecologist for a first visit, an initial visit. And when she was led into the corridor outside the room by a secretary and turned over to the physician was standing there with a drug saleswoman and said, "Do you mind if this woman comes in and sits in on our discussion and exam?" Now, the doctor is paid a significant amount of money, $250, $500 or something, to do that for an afternoon. I mean, this is pure chicanery. You know, everyone's become so numb, so ethically numb to the imprudence of this kind of thing.
Well, you know, the drug industry, as you well know, says that doctors are very busy. They need the drug reps, need to be able to provide them information about drugs in a social setting because there's just no time in the office. And so taking them to a ball game or to a conference away from the office is the only way they can really instruct them about the use of the medication.
You know, I would have less objection to that if the way drug salespeople, and you notice I refer them as salespeople, not as reps, because they are salespeople, just like car salespeople. And if it was really true that the objective was to give good clinical, accurate clinical information about the effects of drugs and the toxicities, then they would measure their drug salespeople on the basis of how well they conveyed that by, for instance, questioning physicians or having them, paying them to fill out a form to make sure they are well informed and they have been instructed about all the toxic side effects and potential problems. But they're not. They're rewarded on the basis of how the doctor changes his or her prescribing patterns and increases the sales of the drugs. If this information was really valuable to physicians, they would make time in their busy schedules to receive it. One of the reasons they don't want to and they have to be bribed is because there's a lot of disinformation and a lot of misinformation conveyed at these sessions.
But Dr. Gerstein, you mentioned the doctors, and some critics say, what about the doctors? I mean, they're half of this equation. Shouldn't they be punished for taking the money, taking the trip, or at least shouldn't there be, you know, is there a way of having some kind of ban on that? They're half of the equation.
It's a two-way street. And if it's banned, I would suppose that it is banned, and it then becomes a legal requirement for physicians and something actionable by the Board of Registration of Medicine should they accept those kinds of inducements. Now, there is a type of inducement that also goes on that's egregiously improper, and that is inviting physicians to fancy resorts and weekends and calling them, quotes, consultants, close quotes. It's nothing really, in essence, but a marketing program. But then at the end, they'll ask physicians, well, you know, is this a good program to instruct you on the drug? And, you know, they can check a box, yes or no, pick up their $1,000 check and fly home. So I'm not sure whether this approach, for whatever it does, is probably not going to control that aspect of the consultancy or pseudo-consultancy aspect of drug promotion.
Well, Dr. Gerstein, I want you to speak to a couple of the critics of the Massachusetts proposal. One is Thomas Finneran, a former politician and now chief executive of the Massachusetts Biotechnology Council. He says a measure like this is going to stifle the biotech, the new and blossoming biotech industry. And he says just adds another layer of bureaucracy, and it's going to keep people from really, you know, getting through doors and talking to people about new innovations.
Well, that's what he's paid to say. He's paid royally to say that, and I'm not surprised that he does say it. But I think in truth, as I say, if information is important, physicians will figure out a way to get it that's not channeled through biased drug company representatives. And I stopped seeing them about 15 years ago because I just felt that there was an occasional nugget of information that was useful to me, but it was surrounded by so much marketing trash that it just was no longer worth my time, effort, and energy.
Dr. Joe Gerstein, a former Tufts Health Plan administrator in Massachusetts, also a whistleblower who sued a drug company after they offered him money to keep their drug on his company's preferred drug list. Dr. Gerstein, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Still to come today, soldiers in Iraq who take up cameras along with their weapons. You're listening to Here and Now. Tension, T-E-N-S-I-O-N, and suspense, S-E or C-E, will be on display in primetime tonight when the annual Scripps National Spelling Bee will be broadcast for the first time on network television. In recent years, spelling bees have exploded in popularity with the best-selling book and movie starring Richard Gere. It's called Bee Season. The documentary Spellbound, another movie in theaters called Aquila and the Bee, and of course the Broadway smash hit, the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. Well, the Scripps Spelling Bee took off in the mid-90s. Who could forget the 13-year-old homeschooler Rebecca Seelfin, who captured the nation's attention with this winning performance in 1997.
Unim!
She still has to spell it.
E! U! O! N! Y! N-U-M!
Correct.
Oh, I just loved her. Rebecca's unusual cadence and enthusiasm haven't changed much. Here now's Kevin Sullivan, caught up with Rebecca. She's now a college grad, and he got her take on all the buzz around the bee.
Hi, it's good to be on the show.
And Rebecca, I still remember that day, you know, very clearly in my mind when you won the spelling bee. Can you remind us again, what was that word and what did it mean?
Unym, E-U-O-N-Y-M. And what it means is a name that's particularly appropriate for what it denotes.
So why do you think that that spelling bee finals that was broadcast on ESPN, why do you think that really put the spelling bee in the national limelight?
First of all, I think that it was one of the early ones that was broadcast on ESPN, so people were sort of looking for an image of the spelling bee. And in my particular year, there was this one person, at least his television persona, was very different from mine. And we lasted 9 rounds together, which was a really long time. So that meant that there was just this very interesting little duel between me and him. And I think the whole idea of people, both of whom had done so well, but we were, in a lot of ways, as far apart in terms of what our television personas were as two spellers could be.
I just wanted to ask you how your spelling skills are these days.
Same as they ever were.
So do you mind if we give you a couple from a spelling bee that someone in the Boston area took part in recently?
No, thank you. I don't want to be asked.
Oh, you don't want to be asked? What make the toughest words?
I think that the toughest words are words that are extremely unphonetic. My personal favorite is Akimesh, which is a twin window derived from Islamic architecture. And that's how it's pronounced. But, okay, if I spell it for you?
Please do.
Its spelling is A-J-I-M-E-Z. Many of the longest words in the dictionary actually come from fairly commonly used roots from languages that a fair number of English words come from.
So the longer words aren't necessarily the more difficult ones?
The longer words are usually not the most difficult.
What's another word that maybe has stumped you in the past?
The year I won, one of the word I misspelled, and fortunately the other person misspelled it too, was Dulcinea. D-U-L-C-I-N-E-A.
Spanish, I take it.
Spanish.
So what does it mean?
Sweetheart.
Since you won, you know, there have been scores of articles written about you, websites dedicated to your win, and there's even been a South Park character sort of based on you. What kind of pressures does that put on a kid, and what advice would you give the winner?
The advice I would give to all people in the spelling bee, whether they win or whether they lose, is to sort of keep an even head about things. It's quite emotionally involving to be part of this thing that you've spent a lot of time doing and preparing for, but it doesn't change the course of your life if you don't let it.
You gave some advice on how to deal with fame. What sort of spelling advice would you give to these young people taking part in the contest?
Same thing. Don't lose your head when you're at the microphones.
Hey, Rebecca, thanks so much for talking to us.
Okay. Bye-bye.
That's Rebecca Seelfin talking with Kevin Sullivan, the 1997 Scripps National Spelling Bee champ. This year's Spelling Bee Championship rounds will be broadcast live on ABC from 8 to 10 tonight. Stay more. Stay here. Well, I give up. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Sounds of a raid in Fallujah in November of 2004, as heard and seen by the National Guardsmen who took part. It's from a new documentary, the first of its kind, called The War Tapes. Filmmaker Deborah Scranton gave video cameras to members of Charlie Company, 3rd of the 102nd Mountain Infantry, which is based in New Hampshire. She asked them to tape their lives in Iraq. The War Tapes is opening in New York City tomorrow and throughout the country later this month. And filmmaker Deborah Scranton joins us from Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
We're also joined by two of the soldiers who were given those cameras and are featured in the film. Michael Moriarty was born in Beverly, Massachusetts, but raised in Arlington down the road from us. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And Zach Bazzi comes from Watertown, Massachusetts. Zach, welcome to you as well.
My pleasure to be here.
I want to start with you two guys. Zach, Michael, chime in. What did you think when someone wanted to give you a camera?
Oh, no.
Really?
Well, Zach here. I actually recall this pretty clearly. Deborah Scranton came to the unit, and she stood in front of the entire company and basically articulated her vision. And she gave us a promise, and she said basically if we chose to participate in her endeavor, the final product will be kind of unfiltered, raw representation of what we did in Iraq, but with no political lens or ideological kind of leaning to it.
Well, I'll tell you, watching it, Deborah, one of the feelings I came away with was claustrophobia. I mean, a lot of the film is shot from within the vehicles. You went through, what, 900 hours of tape. What feelings did you come away with?
For me, it was about trying to get as close to the experience of war as possible, to climb inside. And the guys did an amazing job of mounting, you know, the tripods on the dashboard of their Humvees, on the gun turrets. We had a few POV cameras that they would mount on their Kevlar as well as a thermal imaging camera. And they just dedicated themselves so much to take us along day in and day out to, you know, give us this great gift.
Mike, one of the things that came out, at least from your tape, is, well, feelings about KBR, the Kellogg Brown and Root, the subsidiary of Halliburton. This is the company that Vice President Dick Cheney has had close ties to and does a lot of the private contracting in Iraq. I want to listen to a segment when you speak pretty critically of these private contractors. Let's listen.
When you're out there, you start to think about reality, and the reality is, why the f*** am I sitting here guarding this truck full of cheesecake? Are these people crazy? I feel like the priority of KBR making money outweighs the priority of safety.
You know, soldiers, particularly our unit, we know what we were getting involved in when we signed up for the military and when we went to Iraq. We don't mind, as an infantry unit, it is our job to be placed in harm's way. That being said, we don't want to be put in that situation unnecessarily. Yeah. You find yourself in the middle of the night in a very hostile territory watching a truck for several hours that's disabled waiting for recovery assets, only to find out that the truck is full of things like cheesecake and DVDs. And then you ask yourself, what the hell am I doing? My kids are sitting at home waiting for me to get back.
Zach, you had a particular relationship with the people in Iraq. You're originally from Lebanon. Deborah, you cut back and forth between the guys in the field and their family back home. And in the film, Zach's mother talks about how you, Zach, joined the army so that you could get money for college, that she took you away from Lebanon to keep you safe, and that you ended up in Iraq. She's pretty broken up about that. But what did your speaking the language? We see scenes where you're speaking the language with the people there. How did that give you a different interaction?
It allowed me, at a personal level, it was a vehicle for empathy and sympathy with Iraqi people. And more importantly, though, from a tactical infantry, soldier perspective, it allowed me to do my job in a more efficient, more effective way.
At one point in the film, you talk about not wanting to translate some orders that were given to these civilians because the orders didn't make any sense to you.
The squad would come up to me, hey, well, tell this guy he can't take his sick baby to the hospital. I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to do that. Just you tell him. We're just following orders. I know, but I don't want to translate. If the colonel wants to do it, he can come down himself and do it. It goes in against why we're there. It goes against a lot of our beliefs and the value system we operate under as American soldiers. What's interesting about this incident is a couple days later, our battalion commander came down and he was driving up and down that road, talking to troops, Thanksgiving Day type thing, asking them about their morale. And as far as I can recall, almost every soldier told him how this order at our level made no sense, how it is, you know, inhumane. If anything, it's making insurgents out of otherwise ordinary people. So that to me was awesome, how a lot of the soldiers had this, you know, amazing capability to empathize and sympathize with the Iraqis and let the chain of command know about sometimes the lack of wisdom in their orders.
Hmm. Both Zach and Mike and Deborah, as you looked at these pictures, it could go, for hours of what seemed like, you know, just boring, mundane life. I mean, at one point, I think it's Zach who photographed trucks carrying septic waste and emptying the septic waste, you know, unloading their cargo.
Streams of poop water. We are bringing democracy and good vegetation to Iraq.
And then in the next second, because the cameras are in the vehicles. Deborah, did you find yourself cutting those things next to each other? Is that really how life happened?
It's a 360-degree war. As soon as they lock and load and leave the wire or leave the base, they are the front lines. And there is no way of knowing when that instant is, when an IED is going to go off or a V-bid's going to hit or you're going to get attacked. There is just no way to know. And it did come out of nowhere.
I think by definition, no medium can ever capture authentically war, but you can attempt. I think this movie, more than any others I've seen, is as close as it's going to get. It captures some of the psychological essence of it, the fact that, you know, they're using guerrilla tactics on a traditional force, and a lot of it is just ultimately, no matter how hard you train, if that insurgent decided to pull the fuse when your Humvee drove by, your time is up.
Well, Mike, we know you joined up in the aftermath of September 11th, and yet it feels in the end as if you've become somewhat disillusioned. Let's listen to one scene in particular and then talk about
it. It's so hard to look at things in a positive light as far as Iraq goes. Whenever anything happens that's positive, they all get excited, and it doesn't last for any length of time. Eventually, they'll be shooting at us again.
Mike, how do you look back and look at that film, which forces you to look back on your service in Iraq?
Now when I look back on it, I know that we made progress, and I know that we are making progress in Iraq. My frustrations mostly pertains to infrastructure. We would spend millions of dollars restoring a turbine power plant that was damaged back in the early 90s, and it would be up and running, and you would think, geez, this is great. All right, these people are going to start to see the benefits of us being in their country. And then, you know, a few weeks later, the insurgents would blow the thing up. As a human being, that's unmotivating.
Zach Batsy, will you be going back to Iraq?
Well, I'm still in. Actually been recently promoted to staff sergeant. If they ask me to go, of course, it's not an option, nor should it be an option for me.
What do you say to your mom?
Well, you know, this wasn't my first deployment. I've already been deployed to Bosnia and Kosovo with the 101st Airborne Division. So she knows the drill. I think, you know, regardless of the political context of certain wars and, you know, foreign policies and so on, being in the Army is something that's been very beneficial for me over the years. And I feel a great deal of loyalty for the Army.
Zach Batsy and Mike Moriarty, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've also been speaking to filmmaker Deborah Scranton. Deborah, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much, Robin, for having us.
For more information on The War Tapes, go to our website, here-now.org. And Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.